Hello, and thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast.
Today, I wanted to talk to you about SSH and what I've been doing with it. Man, I bet you're excited already. I have been working on my MacBook in the Unix terminal, and I've been trying to figure out what SSH does. I've kind of understood. I've seen some apps for it before on the App Store, which I'll get to in a second. And now I finally know what they're for. Shoot. But I couldn't do anything with it. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know, you know, why it was useful or necessary. But now I kind of get it, and I'm starting to understand some of the cool administrative tools that you can sort of work with around SSH. But SSH is sort of the secure shell system. I guess, what was the other one? Telnet? Was it the non-encrypted version of it? But it was this version of logging into a host as a client. What was it? A Unix host. Like, you can still do this with servers, like your web server if you have a website, or even Bluehost. I tried this out with Bluehost. You can SSH into Bluehost and look at the files in your Unix terminal on Bluehost, but you can log in as a client and then view that if you have credentials and access. It's really interesting how you can do it, but I guess it was set up a long time ago. It's amazing this kind of tools and power you can have with it. I guess you can do something similar to a VPN, where you can get like private traffic, or you can make your network traffic private by making it appear as though it's like on or behind a router. So it's kind of interesting how you can do that, but I think it's like something like SSH tunneling, where if I were out at a coffee shop or something, I could SSH into my home computer and then access the internet from that secure shell point, like through my home internet. So would it appear as though the internet traffic was being routed through my home and then to me? And then it would be encrypted along that path, so the intermediary, let's say like a coffee shop, wouldn't know anything about it. Super interesting. That's kind of how VPNs work too. Just starting to figure out some of this networking stuff. If you guys know about it, shoot me a message or something. Explain it to me. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
You can see more of my work at billynewmanphoto.com. You can check out some of my photo books on Amazon. I think you can look up Billy Newman under the authors section there and see some of the photo books on film, on the desert, on surrealism, on camping. Some cool stuff over there.
This last week, I made a trip out to Central Oregon, and it was still really nice. You know, we had a little bit of rain, I think, out there last Thursday, Friday, and then Saturday, Sunday, it just brightened up a ton. It was super crisp out, super bright, really cold though. I think my friend Dave had just gone out to Eastern Oregon, I think out towards Smith Rock, and he said it was super cold out there too. But yeah, this trip, we did like an overnight trip out there. And I think today I just posted a photograph of something I thought was really cool. It's one of the archaeological remains that are out in Eastern Oregon. And there's a whole interesting history about stuff in Eastern Oregon. But the photo that I posted to Instagram and to Facebook and all the other places today is a photograph of this rock teepee ring that's still in very good condition. It's out in Eastern Oregon in this area, in between, sort of near like where a dry lake bed, where once just a lake would have been. Now what we see in our modern time is just a dry lake bed. But the cool thing is as we kind of look around, you can see the remnants of an old Indian camp that was really quite established in that area. I think it's just amazing to get to go see. And you'll find other artifacts from Indian populations out in Eastern Oregon once you start looking around. Like, you'll start noticing obsidian chips that are on the ground, or you'll start noticing really in like some places, through a lot of Oregon, through a lot of the less developed, less forested areas of Eastern Oregon, there's a lot less erosion that's taken place, natural erosion that's taken place over the last few hundred years. Like over here on the west side of the coast, with all the deciduous plant matter that comes up, there's a lot of turnover that seems to happen. Like a lot of the vegetation is going to end up hiding or overgrowing some of the older encampments or establishments that were made. I mean, right now I'm in the Camas Valley, I'm in the Willamette Valley, where the Kalapuya Indians, where I'm sure out here in front of me in this big field out toward the Willamette River, there's tons of Indian artifacts, tons of old Indian camps, but none of that's really visible because of all the deciduous organic material that's been developed over here over the many hundreds of years since it's been that there was an Indian population in the area. Now, what's interesting about Eastern Oregon is that because it's way more remote, there's very few people out there. There's very few people to disturb a lot of things. And really, sagebrush doesn't grow very fast. Things don't really move around very fast out there. I was there, I think, maybe more than a decade ago, and it was really almost the same as it is now. Very little has changed out there. You know, no new houses, no new development, maybe a fence around the thing. That might be it. But it was really cool. So you get out to this area, you hike out to a spot, and you can really see all over the ground. It's just a ton of black obsidian chunks, these unworked pieces of black obsidian that were carried in by people and then dropped there at some point. And all these pieces were used, I think, in the camp to chip out arrowheads and to chip out other tools that they would use. But it's really cool. This teepee ring is really the only... well, there's a few teepee rings, like a few smattering of like of piles of rocks. This teepee ring was really the one that was the most established still. It was most upright still. And you wonder, like, how far back do these go? Like, how far back do these stones that were laid into the ground go? But they would use it sort of like as a foundation for the tent or the hut of the teepee that they would have established there. And then they would, you know, work out of it. And they worked out of it on a bluff, and then they would look out over the hill to the lake area. And yeah, I don't know, they just had a whole system out there. But it's really amazing when you really start to come in and sort of understand the layout of the land and where people would sort of go. And it's very interesting, man. Surreal, really, to get out and like be in a spot like that, or sit in the center of the teepee ring, where you know there's people, other men thousands of years ago, that were doing work and trying to survive out in really what is now a very harsh environment, and back then was still probably quite harsh, at least in the hundreds of years ago. But man, if you start going back thousands of years, even a few hundred years ago, I guess 500 years ago, a lot of those dry lake areas out in eastern Oregon really still had at least a marsh, or at least a wetland, or something like that. I mean, like similar to Summer Lake now, you know, parts of the year it's dry, parts of the year it's filled with water. So it might be quite a bit more like that now, but I think in the past it was really, it was just accepted that there was going to be some amount of water in the lake bed all year round, instead of it being, you know, a dry lake bed. And I think it's supported by the watershed of a few creeks that are in the area. And out in that area of eastern Oregon, I don't think there's really that many drainages that really go all the way out toward the coast. So I think there's a few parts that are like landlocked watersheds, where the water flows into an area and then kind of pools up and makes a large lake there. And well, I know like there's the Klamath Lake, and then that runs out to the Klamath River, so that ends up getting out to the ocean. But I don't know if like places like Goose Lake or just like these inland lake areas, I think they're just fed by the body of water, and I don't really know if a lot of that would actually get back out into the water cycle to head back out toward the ocean and then, you know, come back up or something. So it's kind of interesting thinking about just some of the old watershed stuff that used to be out there, how populations used to try and work around all that. You know, like you go out to a place like Fort Rocky and you read some of the signs, and you look at how back in the Pleistocene area, that whole region out there was part of what's called a pluvian lake. It's like a prehistoric Pleistocene era lake that really took up a huge amount of land out in central Oregon. Really what we think of now is just a large desert area covered with sagebrush, with really very few land features, was actually just all underwater. The land feature of Fort Rock that we've visualized now, I think, came about geologically during the Pleistocene era, before the Ice Age, and probably a while back before that. But during that time, it was underwater. It was under a lake bed, and so that's where you get that formation. It was underwater, and then it kind of eroded around it, this aquifer and lava. Or aquifer and magma, I don't know. It met at a certain time and made this big ring, this big Fort Rock style formation, and that's still what's out there now. But it's really amazing when you get out there and you go see it, and then you kind of start to reckon with the perspective that this all was once underwater. This was like an inland sea. And then after the Ice Age, or before the Ice Age, there's some evidence of kind of, well, I don't know. Who knows? But there's evidence to show that the Clovis people, the Clovis tribes, which I think were the ones that at least in modern archaeology have been identified as the group that was first to come over the land bridge, first to come into the Northwest and populate parts of the West Coast and into the South and onward and such. But I guess these Clovis people had a had like a specific type of way of building their tools, their stone tools that they would use. And that's a bit of a way that you can track some things is if you do find an archaeological artifact, you can kind of identify by the technique used to build the stone tool. Like there's different measures. I think one of the oldest ones that's looked for is fluting. And that was a technique used by the Clovis people where they would sort of make an arrowhead or a spear point, really spear points. I don't know if they had flying bows and arrows at that time, that far back, but they'd build these spear points and they would flute the end, the bottom of it. So like if you were to imagine, it would be kind of this concaved slope that was sort of dremeled out of the bottom base of the rock so that you could kind of fit that down in the center of a stick really and then wind that up. So you kind of make both ends kind of taper off to a point and then you would jam one end into the stick and then wrap it and then I don't know, you know, put sap on it or you know, whatever you could do to fasten it down. But I guess that was one of the techniques that was used early on, and that's one of the things that they look for when they're trying to find really old populations in Oregon. Sometimes it's fluting. That doesn't always mean that it's really old, though, I suppose. But I guess there was like handfuls of different technical or technological generations of a stone tool building out there. And you can kind of tell a little bit. But it's very fascinating stuff. And man, was it not amazing to get out there and to really recognize that, you know, I was around a natural human man-made, well, a semi-natural but man-made artifact of a home or of an establishment that's as old, I don't know how old it is. Maybe it's as old as early Rome, late Rome. Who would know how old it is in comparison to Europe? I'm not really sure. Maybe it goes back even further than that. It seems like there was population in that area of Oregon for thousands of years. I think, was it the Paiute that was out there? Could be different, but I know the Paiute were south of that area. The Paiute were in Lake County, I think like through Heart Mountain, Alvor, Nevada, the Malheur area, all of that was Paiute. So maybe this was still in the Paiute section, but I know that really, you know, like what we've noticed in the last few hundred years, if you were to look at the changes of a map, even within the United States over the last, say, take 600 years, not even 7,000 years, take the last 600 years of the United States of America, and then look at all the different maps that would be the territorial ranges of those people who ended up being in power during that time. It's really interesting to see and to kind of take note to how something that seems permanent or seems to have the nature of permanence in it when you speak about it, like that was the range of the Paiute Indian. Well, was it for 600 years or for that long? Did it move around? Did they have, I don't know, territorial engagements? Was there really that many of them? Were they there all the time? I don't know any of that information. So it's kind of interesting when you sort of think about it, but it could have been any number of large groups of people that probably would have no idea they were called the Paiute Indian. But all really very interesting stuff. And man, was it so cool to get out there and see a real a teepee ring. It's really fun. It's one of the cooler pieces of archaeological artifacts that I've run into. I mean, you know, you see petroglyphs, you see a lot of things, but really, you know, you were sitting in the home of someone that lived thousands of years ago. That lived out in the same place that I do now. You know, really fascinating stuff. But I had a blast going out there and getting to check it out. And it was really, I don't know. I kind of love this stuff with the story, with the background to it, where you kind of get to attach something that you recognize with it, with what you get to talk about or what you get to show with it. So I thought it was a really cool story. It was really fun to get out there and go see it. I remembered it from years ago. I think I'd seen it about 10 or 11, 12 years ago. And I think I had tried to go back to it, but I didn't really see how to or where it was, and I wasn't really sure. It's not something on the map.
You can check out more information at billynewmanphoto.com. You can go to billynewmanphoto.com/support if you want to help me out and participate in the value for value model that we're running this podcast with. If you receive some value out of some of the stuff that I was talking about, you're welcome to help me out and send some value my way through the portal at billynewmanphoto.com/support. You can also find more information there about Patreon and the way that I use it. If you're interested or feel more comfortable using Patreon, that's patreon.com/billynewmanphoto.
Most of this podcast has been brought to you by using Cakewalk Sonar, brought to you by BandLab. Maybe I talked about this a little bit, but BandLab is a website or a company, and I guess it made a purchase of the software Cakewalk Sonar that had been, for a short time, previously owned by Gibson Guitar Company since, like, I don't know, 2011 or something like that. So interestingly, a couple years ago or something, Gibson said, hey, we're not going to do any more updates to the Sonar software. So that's just sort of abandoned. But Sonar was like one of the professional DAW editors for a lot of multi-track recording studios, especially stuff that, you know, that was PC-based recording, other than maybe Audition or Reaper, Tractor. There's a bunch of other stuff out there. But Cakewalk and Sonar have been one of the longstanding multi-track recorders out there. So I guess it was purchased by this company, BandLab. They're continuing to do updates and development in the software. And it's available for free now, which is pretty cool. So you can go to bandlab.com, you download like their installer software, and yeah, you can just download a full functioning version of the top of the line Sonar, was it Cakewalk Platinum Studio, that had come out a couple years ago. And so that's what I'm recording into right now. It's a pretty nice layout. It's working fine on this older Windows 10 machine that I'm working on right now. And it's pretty fun. I'm having a good time recording into it through the audio interface that I've got going, the H4N with the XLR inputs coming in left and right into it. And then it's the two-in, two-out USB interface. So it's just going over like a USB cable out into the computer. And it seems like we're getting great preamp quality, a lot better than we did with the audio digital converter that's in this unit. Apparently you have to take like an analog signal and then crunch that down into data and then get that into the computer so that this DAW can record the, you know, the wave, whatever it's going to do. And apparently it's getting, like technology does, it's getting progressively better over time. So I guess a lot of the things that used to be maybe very expensive for AD conversions are now a bit better, or higher fidelity, or, you know, I don't know, just a full bit. What is it, like CDs are 16-bit, and maybe there's like 32-bit AD conversion or 64-bit AD conversion. So it's probably just a level of recording sampling that's, or maybe that's even just different altogether. I don't really know the process of AD conversion, but what I do know is that this one that I have, that's about 10 years newer than the other one I had, seems to have way better preamps, maybe is what I'd say, but just the way that it's able to control the sound as it comes in, seems like it's much better and doesn't really contain that. It's sort of like this weak digital sound is sort of the best way I would describe it. Something that you would have like early sound cards and stuff like that too, where it just didn't really sound like it had like a full quality of the track to it when you recorded it. So I don't know, kind of silly, interesting stuff. But yeah, this one sounds a lot better than the other one did. And the other one was pretty good for its time. It was a lot better than the sound cards that would have been available for me. And I mean, that's what I was using to record stuff even up to just a couple months ago. So yeah, using the H4N, again, got the keyboard in here, ready to go. I need to figure this out with some other cool stuff. There was like, I don't know, it was set up with a piano sound for a while, and I switched it over to this nice little pad of sound. It's pretty cool. On the Mac, I'm pretty frustrated. I'm on the PC now, right? So on the Mac, there's this great program, I think by Rogue Amoeba, called Farago, something like that. It's this really cool, what would you call it? Like a soundboard app where you can kind of trigger, you can hit a key right like that, but it'll trigger some sound that you have, some, you know, just some patch of sound that you have as a clip in that spot. So you can build your own soundboard. So you have a keyboard, you can punch in like all these different sounds that would play through your computer that you could record and stuff. I really want to use it, but it's like Apple Mac only. And I can't put it on this PC. Shoot. So I think, what was it? Discord, that the chat and call communications platform app that a lot of gamers use. I guess there's like a couple soundboard utilities that those guys use on the Windows side. So there might be something in there where I can do a MIDI controller to have in the background to grab out a couple patches. The thing I'm trying to do though, right, really is to figure out like the MIDI controller that's in Cakewalk and see if I can build my own set of patches. Like I only need like 3 or 4. And then I can hotkey those and record like, oh, this one, that'll be like the intro music and that'll be the outro music. And this will be, I don't know, some amusing sound bite that I can drop in, right? That's what I need. So probably not though. But I'll try and figure something out with it. It's kind of fun goofing around with it. Really, I'm not sure if I'll use this keyboard a lot in the podcasting process, but other than to annoy the poor. Well, I was gonna say folks, but probably just folk, just one or two people that are poorly making the choice to check out this long-winded podcast. So thank you if you made it all the way to 20 minutes and 50 seconds into this program. So, it's kind of fun doing all this audio stuff and working in Cakewalk and Sonar and learning about some audio recording stuff. I got the multi-tracking stuff set up pretty well, so I can do this input. I can do an input into the mic over to the left of me. And then, again, got the keyboard in here. Got the MIDI controller set up to do some recording, too. So that recorded out to a wave, and that'll put together another episode, I'm sure you're excited, of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast. That I'll be able to, I guess, throw up on to my website maybe in the next 24 hours or so. I got to make that part easier. That's the thing that I want to make a little bit more fun is the next, like, I don't know, 40 minutes or so is just trying to, like, get everything open and get this file loaded into my WordPress site. It's got to be, like, a more automated way to do that, right? I should look into that. Maybe that's the sort of automation stuff I need to try and figure out. Thanks a lot for checking out this episode of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast. Hope you guys check out some stuff on billynewmanphoto.com. A few new things up there, some stuff on the homepage, some good links to other outbound sources, some links to books, some links to some podcasts, links to some blog posts. All pretty cool. But yeah, check it out at billynewmanphoto.com. Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of the podcast. Talk to you next time.